This lecture, entitled Zacharias Frankel and the Foundation of the Conservative Movement, is dedicated to the memory and Le'ilu Nishmos, Mr. Herbert Hillman, Chaim Yitzchak Ben Yosef, Mr. Eli Meimron, Mrs. Eliyahu Ben Chaim, and Mrs. Angel Meimron, Mrs. Maknin Bat Yosef, Aleihem HaShalom, a blessed memory. In a previous lecture, we covered the beginnings of an organized reform movement within Germany with the convening of an assembly of reform-minded rabbis in the German city of Braunschweig, or Brunswick. The rabbis in attendance were convinced of the need to reform Jewish liturgy and practice in order to stem the tide of assimilation and acculturation, which had already claimed the defection of a sizable percentage of German Jewry. In the words of Dr. Samuel Hirsch, a prominent Reform rabbi who attended the assembly in Brunswick, quote, "I do not exaggerate when I say that 7/8 of our German youth are completely estranged from any and all meaning of Jewish religious feelings. I claim that this cancer advances daily," end quote. Those who embraced Reform truly believed in the widely accepted theory that progress was the guiding principle throughout all of human history, and that Judaism too was subject to change and was a product of the same historical forces that shaped humanity as a whole. The followers of Orthodoxy, the belief that the established divine principles of Torah Shebiktav and Torah Shebaalpeh, the written and oral law, transcended historical change, similar to the laws of physics, were described by one leading Reform rabbi, Dr. Leopold Stein of Frankfurt, as being, quote, "the dark opponents of progress and civilization," end quote. To give you a sense of the mood of those bent upon reform, I would like to first quote from the introduction to the Theological Gutachten, a collection of approbations of the revised Hamburg Reformed Temple Prayer Book, which was published in the year 1842. And here's on the first page. "For us, the term synagogue does not mean the agglomeration of all of the teachers of the synagogue, but the concrete understanding of Jewish teaching, whose progressive nature can be proved, and which knows how to preserve the divine spirit of the Jewish religion through the course of the ages. The synagogue of the spirit follows principles different from those of a formal and fixed rabbinism, which, happily, forms only a small fraction of our Judaism. In such rabbis, we see a hierarchical authority which we reject as error. Hence, we must hold up to obloquy, says, all of these apostles of regression. Progress, that is our slogan. In Judaism, we distinguish between the kernel and the shell, matter and form, the lasting and the ephemeral, the eternal and the temporal manifestation. This distinction is in the spirit of the synagogue, which disputes ceremonial law with Hillel, but agrees with him that the whole law rests on one essential point, Israel." That one point, of course, is, you know, he's referring to the story that the prospective ger, the prospective convert, came to Hillel and wanted to study Torah standing on one foot. And he told him the entire Torah, the essence of the Torah, is Madison Allah Fachavach Savid, which is hateful for you, don't do to your fellow. And this is that they were very kind to agree with Hillel in this point. "Israel needs more such teachers, and more of them do appear, for our time provides a natural school for such men, and in them we see the possibility and hope of complete Jewish regeneration." He continues on, "But you men of regression," again, he is referring to those who, who commented negatively about this revised reform synod. "You who are kept in bonds by the spirit of the dark ages, you who misjudge the rights of the present, who can see in us nothing but frivolous iconoclasts, in vain do you battle against the necessity of change in religious life." Continues on, Learn wisdom from the sages of former centuries who paid attention to the heartbeat of the times. But if you reject organic change of ritual as heresy and apostasy, then declare its followers as non-Jews simply because they do not recognize all of the phrases of the old rite as obligatory prayers, then, as before, you will further hasten the ruin of our father's religion and will force the supporters of change to abandon you altogether. And it continues on, every attempt to stand in the way of or even to suppress progress will be no more successful than Balaam's attempt to ban and curse, which turned into blessing. The same way, the latest reaction against the temple became helpful rather than harmful, especially since the enlightened teachers in Israel had an opportunity to express themselves in favor of progress. We therefore offer these pages of rabbinic opinions to our contemporaries and posterities as a true monument of progress, and confidently look to the future of which it is written, I'm quoting from Jeremiah 31:33, but this shall be the covenant that I make with the house of Israel. After those days, says the Lord, I will put my Torah in their inward parts and write it in their hearts. For they shall all know me from the least of them to the greatest of them. These words speak for themselves and amply capture the mindset of the advocates' reform and their view of tradition. In the camp of those who embraced progress within Judaism, there were, however, differences of opinion. Some, like Drs. Geiger and Holdheim, the leaders of the radical wing of the movement for change, rejected the divinity of the Torah and viewed halacha, Jewish law, as being a holdover of previous age, not in keeping with Jewish life in the modern age. Holdheim and Geiger are viewed by historians as being the spiritual fathers of today's Reform Judaism. There was a conservative wing, however, within those of the rabbinate who felt the need for reform. They were led by a person who was widely viewed as being both a Talmud Chacham, a Talmudic and halachic scholar, as well as someone who had embraced the idea of progress and that of Wissenschaft, the academic and critical approach to traditional Jewish texts and sources. His name was Zacharias Frankel, and his life and approach is the subject of this lecture. Zacharias Frankel was born in the year 1801 in Prague into a distinguished family of scholars, Talmid HaChachamim, and communal leaders, and received a traditional education. As a young man, he studied under Harav HaGoyim Rabbi Tzalem Ransford, a close Talmud disciple of the famous Yecheskel Landau, the subject of a previous lecture. After receiving smicha, rabbinic ordination, at the age of 24, he traveled to Budapest, Zacharias Frankel, to receive a secular education. Shortly after receiving his doctorate from the University of Pest, he was appointed to the position of chief rabbi of the district of Leitmeritz in Bohemia and resided in the city of Teplitz. This appointment itself was significant as Frankel was the first rabbi in Bohemia who had ever received a university education. In Teplitz, Frankel did not introduce any reforms, despite pressure from members of the community. He did introduce, however, regular sermons which were delivered in the German language, a departure from the then current custom, and also a first for Bohemia. He also introduced measures to ensure order and decorum in the synagogue, a hallmark of reform at the time. In 1836, Frankel was appointed as chief rabbi of Saxony and resided in Dresden, its capital. There in Dresden, began to implement moderate reforms. We have two accounts of Frankel's innovations, both written by Mrs. Bernard Beer, a reform-minded and scholarly lay leader who was a close friend of both Dr. Zacharias Frankel and Abraham Geiger. These accounts were written in the year 1840, shortly after the community's dedication of Dresden's new synagogue. The following summary of those accounts is taken from Michael A. Meyer's well-researched book, Response to Modernity, pages 106 and 107. I quote, on the holiday of Shavuos, A choir of 20 to 30 men and boys was positioned high up in the second gallery, where it responded harmoniously to the chants of the cantor, who led the service from a table located directly in front of the ark. The congregation recited its prayers silently or in unison. Many of the piyutim, religious poems that were added to the service, had been excised, but for the sake of the most traditional worshippers, singing of the Akdomas, you know, the special lengthy Aramaic prayers for the holiday of Shavuos, was retained. During the Torah chant, no one was permitted to sing along out loud. Following the scriptural reading, Chief Rabbi Dr. Frankel ascended the pulpit and spoke on the religious significance of the holiday, applying the verse, "You shall be to me a kingdom of priests and a holy nation," to the mission of Israel. Its task to pass on the word of God through the generations until it becomes the common treasure of all humanity. After the sermon, Frankel went on to conduct a confirmation, as he did every year on Shavuos. This was common, by the way, in the Reform movement.
What is a confirmation?
Just as an aside, the confirmation is really one of the sacraments of the church. And that is that when a child reaches the age close to adulthood, he makes an affirmation of faith. He is taught, there's a catechism which outlines the fundamentals of faith, and there's a ceremony in which he confirms, as a confirmation, his adherence to the faith. That really is part, it was part of the Catholic Church as a sacrament, and also part of the Protestant Church, Lutheran Church. Reform, who felt that it was in the midst of all that was happening and in their urge to merge with the mainline religions, included it, the confirmation ceremony, as part of their ritual. It was really introduced, we had one of the previous lectures of last year, the Israel Jacobson, he was one of the first to introduce this. And it became common within the Reform movement.
Was any food, when you were eating, I was saying, any food, pasta or something?
What?
But was any food, did you serve any, like, was any ritual or something? Was just something they're saying?
From a yidden serve food. After the sermon, Frankel went on to conduct the confirmations he did every year on Shavuos. This time there were two boys and five girls. He asked them questions regarding the most essential points of Jewish belief and practice, then spoke to each of them in turn on his or her plans for the future and gave them his blessing. A German chorale followed, in which some of the Christians present also joined. But the most impressive innovation was yet to come. When the time arrived for the priest to bless the congregation, the folding doors in the side hall opened, and with measured step, 14 Kohanim entered, dressed alike in black clothing, white robes, it must be talasim, and skull caps. In precise and pleasing unison, this choir of priests intoned their blessings of the congregation in alternation with the cantor and choir. And he says, he's quoting now from this Dr. Bernard Beer, tears of the most heartfelt emotion streamed for most every eye. The numerous non-Jews of every station who were present were taken aback. They had not anticipated anything like it, end quote. How very different it was from the customary dissonance. This is really amongst the history of Reform, this is really a common thing about the dissonance, since it doesn't sound like a church choir. The liturgy for the second day of the holiday resembled that for the first, except that the sermon was replaced by a short German prayer, followed by a memorial service, Yisker. Later that year, observance of the Tisha, on the 9th of Av, the fast day, which commemorates the destruction of the first and second temples, was similarly transformed. The rituals of Tisha B'Av had been the subject of the severest critique, not only by radicals who saw no reason for the mourning for mourning the demise of the ancient sacrificial service and bewailing the diaspora, but also by moderates who repelled by the cruder customs and therefore tended to stay away from the public service. But in Dresden this year, the worship was not as it had been. Once again, we have Beer's account. As congregants arrived on the eve of the fast day, those who chose to remove their shoes as a sign of mourning were required to do so in the entrance hall outside the sanctuary and put on a presentable foot covering in their place. No one was permitted to bring low benches or sit on the floor. When they entered, worshippers found the synagogue draped in black and dimly lighted, so the pulpit area remained shrouded in darkness. Only a pale shimmer of light reflected from a silver shield of David hanging above the ark somewhat illuminated its surroundings, as if to symbolize the lone ray of Israel's hope. Instead of the cacophonous wailings which characterize the traditional service on this day, the lamentations were rendered by cantor choir in congregation in a restrained but sincere manner. The next morning, Frankl gave a sermon in which he alluded to the persecution just then suffered by Jews in Damascus. This was in 1840, as a result of the ritual murder accusation leveled against them there. The singing by cantor and choir of the medieval poet Yehuda Levi's famous ode to Zion in the Elit Zion concluded the observance. Even the most venerable elders in the congregation, Beer concludes, had to concede that this year, even though they had not sat on the ground, they had for the first time experienced truly heartfelt mourning at the grievous loss of the ancient sanctuary. Dr. Meyer concluded his description of Zacharia Frankel's other innovations as follows. Quote, such transformations of the atmosphere of worship occurred in many German communities, especially when a new synagogue was erected or a new rabbi assumed this position. They did not violate halacha, and they left the liturgy mostly intact, merely excising some of the late and secondary accretions. Generally, they were called simply improvements, Verbesserungen, rather than reforms. This reminds me of in the period, Mitzvah Hashem, in future lectures we'll deal with this, but in the Yiddish movement, where to acculturate Jews, they began translating what would be classic humanistic works into the Yiddish language. So there was an advertisement for, I believe it was the Merchant of Venice or Midsummer's Night Dream, one of Shakespeare's plays. And it was, and the advertisement was übergesetzt und verbessert. You know, it was translated and improved. Okay, so we'll continue on. Generally, they were called simply improvements, Verbesserungen, rather than reforms. And they're clearly responses to the altered religious sensibility evoked by acculturation. However, there were some passages in the basic liturgy itself that became ethically and politically problematic for even moderate reformers. Frankl, for instance, in 1843, changed a number of ancient prayers, including the daily Vela Malshinim, which vividly petitions for the destruction of slanders and of God's enemies. A comparison of its texts indicates the radicality of Frankl's alteration. The traditional formula reads, it begins in the first thing which he kept intact, and for the slanders let there be no hope, let all evildoers perish swiftly. The second part reads, and all your enemies be speedily cut off, uproot, crush, cast down, and humble the arrogant speedily in our days. Blessed are you, O Lord, who breaks enemies and humbles the arrogant. Zaydim. Frankel's version reads, again, it begins the same, V'lanoshim al-tisikim v'l-risha k'rega toive, is the same. Then, V'azei de mehira sachnia sh'yeshuva yalecha. Says, and speedily humble the arrogant so they may return to you. And then he just ends off quickly, Baruch atah Hashem shover ovim machnia zedim. So, says, breaks the evil and humbles the arrogant. But he made that change. Similar alteration of this prayer, or its omission, became, this is common elsewhere. I mean, we're seeing that with the advent of reform. Another candidate for change or elimination was a passage in the twice weekly prayer, V'hu Rachum, which you say Mondays and Thursdays, the longer form of Tachlin, which in the traditional text reads, you know, right before in the Tefillas Apayim, says Kael Habita Dalku, says Kvaydenu Bagoyim Vishikutsenu Ketumas Anida Admosa Uzcho Bashvi Separtecho Biadzor Oreg Vurosho Vikinoscho Loivecho Hem Yevoshu Viyachtu Migvurosho. Says they, Israel's enemies, have detested us like the impurity of a menstruant woman. How long will your strength remain captive and your glory in the hand of the foe? Arouse your might and zeal against your enemies. They put to shame and shattered in their might. Frankel and others simply skipped over this passage, which to them was both morally offensive and politically provocative. Now, although Frankel was relatively very conservative in the reforms that he advocated, in comparison to others, he was nevertheless sympathetic with the general cause of reform. He wished, however, to shape it into a more moderate form than his more radical colleagues, such as Geiger and Holdheim and their ilk. For instance, when the Landsrabiner of Sachsen-Meiningen, says Hilberghausen, Joseph Hoffman, officially sanctioned Jewish high school students to take written tests on Shabbos, Dr. Frankel vigorously protested and published his protest in the periodical The Orient. In a similar vein, in the light of the criticism that was directed towards the new Hamburg Temple prayer book by the chief rabbi of Hamburg, Chacham Bernays, in the year 1842, Frankel published an article in the periodical The Orient, criticizing Chacham Bernays for his condemnation and offering general support of the Hamburg Temple Association's right to publish their own siddur. At the same time, however, most of the article was devoted to the siddur's shortcomings. In his prayer book Reform in Europe, this is by Dr. Jacob J. Petachowski, he summarized Frankel's article as follows. One, Herr Bernays, that's what he calls him. You should have the Chaim Yitzchak Bernays was Mamshon Odom Godel. He was a tremendous Eloi, a tremendous prodigy. He was a Boki B'chol Chadrei Torah. He had tremendous depth and breadth. He was the Rebbe of Rosh Hashanah Folhosh. So I'm just saying he was not, when we get Amir Tashem to the biography of Rosh Hashanah Folhosh, we'll touch upon his relationship with Chacham Bernays. Herr Bernays is extraordinarily mistaken in the manner in which he expressed himself about the new prayer book of the Temple Association. That's one. Two, Herr Bernays has wrongly decided that one cannot pray the Tfilas Chova, the obligatory prayer from this book, since all prayers required for Tfilas Chova are found therein. Now, just as an aside, it's interesting to note, however, that Frankel made that statement despite the fact that the korbanos, the sacrifices, were largely deleted, and the siddur was condemned by the greatest authorities of the previous generation, including Rav Kiv Eger, Moshe Sofer, the Chassam Sofer, as we quoted in a previous lecture. We now continue on. Three, on the other hand, this prayer book of the Temple Association does not at all lend itself to use as a popular prayer book, because the holiest sentiments of the nation are to a large extent suppressed in it, and because, altogether, there are missing from it the soulful and most intimate aspects connected with the Hebrew prayers. 4. The new prayer book of the Temple Association lacks a scientific basis and the kind of dignified seriousness which judges with deliberation. The revision shows haste and hurry and an inexact evaluation of this important and holy subject. This prayer book, therefore, on account of its inconsistencies, can claim neither validity nor recommendation. So, in other words, Dr. Frankl was critical of the Orthodox, those who criticize any attempt at reform in general, was equally critical of the radical reforms that were proposed by the Hamburg Temple Association. As we covered in previous lectures, the Hamburg Temple Siddur did away with most of the expressions for the desire of a personal Mashiach, rebuilding of Jerusalem as the capital of a revitalized Jewish nation, and the building of a temple where korbanos, where sacrifices, would again be offered. Now, Frankl did not criticize these deletions on the grounds of their being heresy apocursus, but rather as being insensitive to the historical longings of an exiled people, as well as being quote-unquote unscientific. In other words, Frankl felt that there is a science to the changing revolution of the religion of Judaism, and any change which would not be in keeping with this science is therefore unscientific. A criticism to which the westernized Reformed Jews of Hamburg, or perhaps any other community contemplating reform, would perhaps respond. In other words, the fact that the belief system of the members of the Hamburg Reform Association was apocursus, heresy, a departure from traditional beliefs as charged by Chacham Bernays and the opinions of the great authorities published in Ela Divrei Abris, did not faze them. But by charging them as being unscientific, Dr. Frankl felt that he would be more influential, especially with communities who were perhaps contemplating replacing the traditional Siddur with the Hamburg Siddur. Like, no one wants to be unscientific. Not frum, that's a sign of being intelligent. But not being scientific is a bizoin. Seeing that some form of reform was the wave of the future and disturbed the radical direction it was taken, in 1844, Dr. Frankl began publishing a scholarly journal in support of moderate reform entitled Zeitschrift für die religiösen Interessen des Judentums, or Journal for the Religious Interests of Judaism. Beginning on page, here in your notes, on page 1, this is in section 2, we quote from the prospectus of Frankl's new journal. A, here. In these pages, we shall emphasize the progress of Judaism. We shall conceive it to be our task to avoid the kind of negative reform which leads to complete dissolution, but instead to show how the teachings of Judaism itself contain the possibility of progress. We need to talk and counsel together because we share the deep sorrow over the threatening destruction of the synagogue and the undermining of its foundations. We have the sad conviction that, in dispensing with the unnecessary parts, we are also giving up too much of that which is necessary. Meanwhile, many people display nothing but a dull indifference instead of the deep religiosity of former days, and we notice there are many who, misunderstanding the depths of Judaism, wish to dissolve it in the general mood of the modern age. The synagogue faces a crisis. But this must not dishearten us, nor must we give way to doubts that it can be victorious. For the innermost content of Judaism is guaranteed both in its continued existence as well in its latent possibilities of self-development. How such development shall take place must be determined by scientific research based on positive historical foundations. Not every point of view can predominate. Not every hypothesis can succeed. But this must not discourage us from undertaking our investigations as long as they are begun with sincerity and dignity and are continued in a scientific manner. We may give room to the hope that even our weak attempts may lead to more mature studies and finally to results of practical utility. For we must understand there is nothing but disaster in that kind of absence of motion and deed behind which one looks in vain for certainties, or in that hesitance which fears to awaken new doubts or to provoke attacks upon tradition which heretofore have not been challenged. Such silence without defense encourages opponents to make further attacks. And in its apathy, there is admission of obvious weakness which arouses doubts even amongst the neutrals. We aim to secure that which can be maintained in our tradition, as well as to eliminate that which disfigures the purity of our faith. We want to oppose unworthy tampering with our tradition, at the same time eliminate all reasons for doing so. We want to reconfirm and reinforce. We want to alleviate all doubts. In order to do this, it is our inescapable task to speak publicly through worthy scientific study about the nature, the eternity, and the progress of Judaism, and to offer a guide for learning and further study. Motivated by such thoughts, the editor, in cooperation with other theologians who share these convictions, has founded this monthly journal for the religious interests of Judaism, and this was authored, of course, by Zacharias Frankel. Notice that we have underlined and bolded those ideas that make Frankel stand apart from both the Orthodox, who strictly adhere to tradition, and the Reform, who in their attempt to make Judaism more in keeping with a Christian expression of religiosity, removed essential elements of Judaism. The idea of the development of Judaism and the power of communities to decide to do away with this or that practice is, on the whole, a strong departure from the Orthodox Judaism of Frankel's youth. In order to justify even the moderate reforms that Dr. Frankel proposed, he needed to show that Judaism was, to a great degree, at least in regards to the oral law, the Torah Shaval Peh, an invention of the rabbis of old who molded Judaism to the needs of their age rather than being a product of divine revelation. As we will soon see, Frankel proposed that the vehicle for implementing changes resides with the changing sentiments of the religious community as a whole, and cannot be merely implemented by the whims of reform-minded rabbis such as Drs. Geiger and Holtheim. It seems that Dr. Frankel maintained that Hashem actually endowed the community with such power. The term positive historical, which denotes both the divine source of halacha, the positive, as well as the forces of history that modify it, became the phrase with which Dr. Frankel is most closely identified. Conservative Judaism views itself as the movement within Judaism which most closely embodies these principles. In the first volume of his publication, or the Journal for Religious Interests of Judaism, Frankel laid out in further detail his vision for reform. And this is here on page 2, Paragraph B. Time hurries onward and radical reforms are demanded, but we do not want to forget that not all demands of our time are justified. But on the other hand, we cannot overlook the fact that the long-standing immobility of the past needs rectification. Until a few decades ago, Judaism had for a long period been in a state of total immobility. It satisfied the people and therefore their teachers did not have the right to introduce reforms, even if they had been able to transcend their age. The great gap between yesterday and today has still not been bridged, and the will of our people is still firmly rooted in the past. Notice the phrase, the will of our people. This idea that the people are the sole determining factor in Judaism, working in conjunction with the original divine revelation, is Frankel's Chiddush, his novel contribution to Jewish philosophy and the movement for reform. And we continue on. As long as this will still pulsates strongly, we cannot and will not touch it. Rather, it must be the desire of our teachers to gain the confidence of the people by leading them gently so that ultimately they may be granted the right to reform. In other words, unless the people want it, says it can't be done. It cannot be dictated on high. All that the progressive rabbis can do is influence the people to change their will. Yeah. And we continue on. Will these reforms then be valid? When the will of the people is expressed through these teachers, when they make reforms in full knowledge of their time and the spirit of the people, what dictum, what authority could deny them this right? The will of the people, this strong power which Judaism recognizes, this will be validated by history and science. And this, by the way, Frankl felt strongly that his novel vision of the power of the community to institute changes would be validated through a scientific analysis of biblical and Talmudic literature. We'll further discuss this in this lecture. And continue on, represented, this is this validated by history and science, and represented by teachers of truth and loyalty to our faith, would not these be valid? For some time now, it has been suggested that a synod be called, where theologians would agree on reform. But a time for such a realization has not come as yet. The theologians do not express the will of the people, for they have not yet gained their general confidence, partly because through their own fault, and partly because the popular will cannot be expressed as long as there is inner strife and as long as the struggle between the old and the new is fought so fervently. But time will heal and help to fill the gap between yesterday and today. The teachers will find in their own lack of success a new challenge to fulfill the duties which their position imposes upon them. Thus, they will become conscious of the will of the people and will become truly living representatives, and reforms will come not out of the people's illnesses, but grow from living principles. Representation of the total popular will and of science, these are the two main conditions for reform of Judaism. Next to faith, the Jew puts his confidence in science. His whole past history of study and mental orientation guarantees that without a genuine science of Judaism, our theologians will never have any influence upon the people. In such a science, history too will find its just tribute and due recognition. I'm just as an aside, basically what he was dealing with, I mean, in his world view, was there were a group of people, there were Erlich Yidden, traditional Jews. They did not want to see any reform. There was a group of people who were totally unaffiliated. The education was very poor. The magnetism of acculturation was great. And the leaders of reform really responded to that group and wanted to include that group, and that's the reason that they, as we'll see, clamored for major reforms. But in doing so, they pushed aside those Jews who were truly religious and committed. What Frankl wanted to do was to change the attitude of all of Jewry. That those people that were committed should really, on their own, understand the need to reform. That's just as a background to understand where he's coming from. And I'll continue on. It would be too bold to anticipate the shape of a future which perhaps is not far away, to determine whether it will find a common way for both faith and life. But at the same time, it would be a total misreading of the great ferment of our time if on one hand one criticizes the status quo, on the other hand the lack of definitive reform. The opposites do not as yet permit of a compromise. Either reform will break itself on the wall of opposition, because it was tremendous opposition by people who were committed to Torah, or will dissolve tradition without displacing it and will destroy without maintaining it through progress. You notice Frankl's utter opposition to reform as it became manifest in Germany. He felt that this was just as destructive. It's not going to lead people to... In other words, Those who are irreligious will still not be brought back to the shul, and basically is that it's destroying that which we have. That was his view. We aim at a worthy representation of the total will of the people and at a science of Judaism. These will lead us to our goal and aid us to find that measure for reform which will live not only in abstraction, but can be translated into reality. Our slogan is moderate reform, which properly understood will be Judaism's saving force, will contribute to its eternal continuity.
He's referring to the science of Judaism. What do you mean?
Yeah, the science of Judaism is, he basically maintained that Judaism underwent change. And that change was an evolutionary change. So it basically is when one studies that evolutionary change and what has happened in the past, and one could predict what form it shall take in the future. That's his.
So he's not referring to the German way of analyzing the Bible or whatever.
No. In terms of, yes, in the German, he himself, as we're going to see, this is the first part of two things dealing with Dr. Frankl. He himself, at least what he claimed, he believed in divine revelation, and he believed in the Torah Shebichtav. He believed that this was the Word of God. He also, though, viewed the Torah Shebaal Peh, much of it at least, that is not as being as understood by all the generations, as part of a tradition that comes all the way back, you know, to Moshe Rabbeinu, to Moses, but something that was created by the religious leaders, the Rabbonim, throughout all the years. And that view, which is really a departure from traditional view, and in traditional view it's apokrisis, it's really it's heresy, though it was is that which enabled him to institute reform. And that was the theory behind any reforms. But he said that basically is the people have the right, or it's based on the sentiments of the people, to make these changes. So it's both through the science, meaning to see the flow of the evolution, to see that which is basic and that which is peripheral, and to guide the people that they should be willing to undergo these changes. That was his view. And that basically was the school that he created. The school in Breslau that he led was called the Jewish Theological Seminary. The school in America that was based on it was also the Jewish Theological Seminary. So in other words, Frankl also felt that certain reforms needed to be implemented in order to ensure the survival of Judaism. He was, however, very cautious on how to proceed, as he saw the reform vision of Drs. Geiger and Holdheim and their group as destroying Judaism and leading to total assimilation. It's no wonder then that Dr. Frankl was a firm critic of the Reform Rabbinic Assembly at Brunswick, which took place in June 1844, which we covered in the previous lecture. Not only did he not attend, but he also published a severe criticism for the whole process. The following is a quote from the rejoinder to that criticism for one of the radical reformers, Dr. Samuel Hirsch, at the time the chief rabbi of Luxembourg. And now we have here and we see from his rejoinder what were the comments of Dr. Frankl here on paragraph C on page 3. I've come across the 8th issue of Dr. Frankl's Zeitschrift, the Journal for the Religious Interests of Judaism, in which the editor denounces the rabbinical conference which took place in June 1844 in Brunswick. With a bitterness which was painfully noticeable, Dr. Frankl announces to the world at the end of his essays that the conference was a failure, and though he pretends to be greatly pained, one cannot avoid detecting a certain malicious gloating on his part. And he continues on. And why did these men make an appearance? only because they believed by the mere fact that this conference would come into being and reconvene annually that the illnesses of Judaism might be healed. These men laid themselves open to public embarrassment, conscious of exposing their good name to criticism. And it continues on. According to Dr. Frankel's utterances about the people, its sound mind, and deep religiosity, it might almost seem as though pure wantonness had brought these men together, as though levity was the order of the day, something not to be forgiven a layman, much less as a group of rabbis. But has Dr. Frankel never been to Leipzig during the fair? Has he never walked through the streets on a Shabbos, a Sabbath, or a holiday? Has he never seen a table d'hôte, or a similarly appointed place for eating and drinking? And he presumes to brag about the religious sense of the people? The people who came to this fair, he said there were, many of them were totally irreligious. They didn't keep Shabbos, Yontif, nor Kashrus. I do not exaggerate when I say that 7/8 of our German youth are completely estranged from any and all meaning of Jewish religious feelings. I claim that this cancer advances daily. And Dr. Frankel could not find the smallest word of praise, of love and encouragement, if not for the men of that assembly, at least for an institution that has taken upon itself the task of finding a solution to this dilemma. I shall now proceed to discuss Frankel's accusations one by one. He enumerates them and he continues, considering the cultural level of today's Jewry, how long do you believe people continue to submit to a ceremony like that of Chalitza, which we discussed in the last lecture? How long do you think they will acquiesce to rules governing marital unions prohibited to a Kohen? If anywhere at all, it is right, it's right here where the damage ought to be repaired before it spreads too far. And continuing on, he says, instead of helping this institution, which could be so beneficial to Judaism, to remain in existence, he chose to nip it in the bud. You know, just by the way, you see, he says, the view of the reformers was they were saving Judaism. They felt that it was just a matter of time that everyone would abandon Judaism. And that's where they felt that if they made the changes, they could keep it intact, at least a changed version, but to keep Judaism intact. This article by itself gives you an idea of the sentiments of the rabbis who met at Brunswick, as well as their disappointment with Frankel, whom they viewed as being a potential ally. Under pressure and amidst great criticism for abandoning the movement for reform, Dr. Frankel did attend the second rabbinic assembly, which took place in Frankfurt, Germany, in July of 1845. On the second day of the conference, Frankel addressed the entire assembly. The following is taken from that address, here in paragraph D. And this is taken from the address. The reform of Judaism, furthermore, is not a reform of faith, but of practices demanded by law. These still live within the people and exercise their power. It is not our task to weaken this influence, but rather to strengthen it as much as possible. We need pay no attention to those individual few who do not practice the customs. We are not a party, but ours is the task to care for the needs of the whole people. We must maintain their true sanctuary and prevent any schism in Israel. We must not bring new parties into existence, but rather must reconcile those which exist already. There's yet another principle to which we must hold, and that is of science, which must be the foundation, for this alone offers a secure path for progress. There are men in Israel who are not present at this assembly, who do not belong to the circle of religious officials, yet whose presence is desirable because they possess the equipment for the science of Judaism. If that which will be decided here is to have a validity, then those men too ought to be asked, as was customary with Shilas and Shuvas, by rabbinic responsa. The decision of the rabbinical conference will in any case be weighed and examined outside of conference. Must make their way first by gaining the support of the experts. Only then will they achieve validity. It would be advisable, therefore, if prior to voting on a subject, the matter would already be published in print. Finally, says the speaker, he believes the rabbinical conference to be a very useful institution, but he wishes to state that he will be able to approve of its meetings only as long as these will always keep in mind the whole of positive Judaism. You notice again, Frankl's stress on science. Science in this context refers to the field first began with Leopold Zuntz, the analysis of the history of Judaism and its customs and prayers. Frankl felt that any changes have to be in keeping with the general historic trend of what he believed to be an evolutionary process of change. Here also he broke ranks with most of the reform-minded rabbis, all the while distancing himself from the Orthodox. The third day of the conference was devoted to the issue of maintaining the Hebrew language in the prayers. Since so many of the already acculturated Jews had such a poor or perhaps non-existent knowledge of Hebrew, those rabbis who focused on ensuring that they too remain attached to the community wanted to phase out the Hebrew language entirely in order to make the temple a welcome place for those people. This was an issue that Frankl was particularly passionate about. He maintained that any attempt to phase out Hebrew was tantamount to phasing out the link between Jewry and its historic roots. The following is a quote from Frankl's impassioned plea to retain Hebrew as the official language of prayer. And here is on page 4 in paragraph E. And this is part of his address. To be sure, it is urgently necessary that part of the service be held in German. However, I believe that Hebrew must predominate, for it carries with it the sentimental elements of edification and stimulation which otherwise are missing in our service. This edification and stimulation which otherwise is provided for by Hebrew, because we are thereby reminded that it is a language of revelation in which God spoke to Moses. For us, Hebrew in the worship service is necessary and should be perhaps have been ordered by law. This would have been the case had our forefathers been able to imagine that we would ever attempt to forsake Hebrew. The old teachers who did permit another language of prayer only had weaklings in mind, who without such permission would not have found themselves at ease with a non-Hebrew prayer. But they never thought that Hebrew would be eliminated from the house of God. Just as an aside, there's a Mishnah in Sota and Daf Lamed Beis in 32. Which speaks about those things that could be only said in Hebrew and those which can be said in other languages. And it says tefillah, davening, could be said in other languages. Because of that, basically on that basis, when the original Hamburg Siddur came, which German was predominated the prayers, they did so basing themselves on that Mishnah. And those who came to their defense did so basing themselves on that mission. To that, those who responded, this, again, we spoke of the compilation of tshuvas, of responsa of the gedolim at the time, the great authorities of the time, in the year 1819, amongst them Rabbi Akiva Eiger, Chassam Sofer, Moshe Sofer, and they said, similar to what Dr. Frankl said, that it was never meant to replace. It was an ad hoc kind of a thing. A person can't, an individual can't daven in Hebrew, doesn't know Hebrew, could use another language. But it was never meant that the other language should replace Hebrew. On the contrary, really, it says Hebrew really has in it so much, and contains with it that which can't even be translated, because there's so many different levels of meaning, that Hebrew must be maintained. This is an emergency measure an individual could pray in another language. And this is really what Dr. Frankl is alluding to. The issue was finally taken to a vote. 13 voted in line with Frankl for the retention of Hebrew language. 3 abstained. 15, a majority, voted in favor of temporarily maintaining Hebrew and eventually phasing it out. With this, Dr. Frankl left the conference and tendered his letter of resignation. Only one other attendee left with him, Leopold Schott, who at that time was rabbi of Rondeg in Baden, another traditionalist. We quoted from him in the last lecture when they had debate about intermarriage. The following is from Dr. Frankel's letter of resignation here on the bottom of page 4. To the honorable officers of the Second Rabbinical Conference in Frankfurt. The maintenance of Judaism is the basic aim of my life and the goal of all my efforts, which I, in my turn, am prepared to bring every sacrifice. Hence, I find myself in irreconcilable opposition to contrary tendencies. Already at the second session of the conference, I brought up the question of principle so that we can understand each other and be entirely clear about the spirit of the conference. For this point was not treated any further. Yesterday's session had a result of which I can think only with sorrow. In vain, finally, were the devotion, the religious force, and sanctity of Hebrew prayer and its edifying power stressed. In vain, the majority of the rabbinical conference decided that Hebrew prayer was only advisable, and that it would be the task of the rabbis to eliminate it gradually altogether. I disagree with such a decision not only because I have a different point of view, but also because I disagree with the tendency of the decision. For this spirit leaves unheeded so many important elements and eliminates the historical element which has weight and power in every religion. In my opinion, this is not the spirit of preserving, but of destroying positive historical Judaism, which I declared distinctly before the assembly was my point of view. This spirit of the assembly deprives all its further decisions of any validity in the eyes of those who adhere to positive historical position. As I explained to the assembly, not only voting is important, but also motivation. Only those who have already made up their mind, merely want a formal approval for their position, can find a superficial satisfaction in general voting procedures. Upon receiving Dr. Frankel's letter of resignation, the assembly issued the following statement. And this is the G on page 5. The Second Rabbinical Assembly has received with great astonishment a letter from Chief Rabbi Dr. Frankel of July 18th, which states that he resigned because of debates of the 17th concerning the objective necessity of Hebrew in our prayers. In the Allgemeine Zeitung des Judentums, of last year, number 26, Dr. Frankel declared that he would appear in this year's rabbinical conference if the moderate views were represented by a number of men. He did appear. The result of the vote on the 17th was that 13 members declared themselves for the objective necessity of Hebrew in prayer, 3 abstained, while 15 declared themselves for the non-existence of such a necessity. The vote showed that in this respect, Dr. Frankel did not at all stand alone. And therefore, if he wanted to follow his published declaration, he had the obligation to remain further in the assembly. On the other hand, the conference vehemently denies that through the voice of the majority, it has forsaken the view of a positive historical Judaism, which had made its own on the 16th by acclamation together with Dr. Frankel. Yet Dr. Frankel... Just as an aside... This part is referring to the assembly's reaction to Dr. Frankel's remarks on July 16th regarding positive historical Judaism being the foundation of any contemplated reform. To this, Dr. Leopold Stein, the chief rabbi of Frankfurt, the president of the assembly, commented, quote, Mr. Frankel remarked that no reform leaves its historic foundation. Gentlemen, is that not the foundation on which all of us find ourselves? To this, there was a response of general agreement. Dr. Stein continued, Dr. Frankel declares that the letter of the Bible is far removed from us and that we can no longer return to it. Therefore, positive revealed Judaism is his principle, a Judaism which in the course of time has unfolded itself historically and must in this manner be carried forward, developed by science. Gentlemen, is this not also our point of view? To this again, there was a response of general agreement. Evidently, though, it seems that Dr. Frankel's ideas about positive historical development and Dr. Stein's were not exactly the same. And let us continue now. Yet Dr. Frankel's letter suggests that the assembly had done the opposite. But the majority had not failed to recognize the high significance of the Hebrew language for the Israelites and the necessity of learning it in the schools. Only it did not hold that it was unconditionally necessary for the worship service. On the other hand, the minority which held the latter view did not in any wise claim that its opponents had left the positive historical point of view. Different points of view were involved here, not different tendencies. The positive historical point of view desires progress out of that which exists. It does not desire haphazard creation without limits and without foundation. Therefore, our prayers shall be built on existing prayers as much as possible, develop in form and content out of tradition. And then it continues on, the assembly therefore believes that Dr. Frankel made this question forcibly into one of tendential import, and when he left the assembly, he left also his point of view and its consequences. After Dr. Frankel left the assembly, the rabbis continued their efforts in establishing a unified system of reform. In the coming lecture, we will cover the reform proposed in the Frankfurt Assembly as well as those of the assembly that was hosted in Breslau the next year under the presidency of Dr. Abraham Geiger, the chief rabbi of Breslau. I'd like to continue this lecture, however, with the further accomplishments of Dr. Zacharias Frankel. After leaving the conference at Frankfurt and sending his resignation to the assembled rabbis, Frankel publicized it widely. For this act, Frankel received many letters of thanks from both individuals and communities. But ultimately, Frankel was in favor of reform, just not the reforms of the secularized rabbis who met at Frankfurt. Although he didn't offer any concrete proposals for reform, as he felt that the form that it would take was subject to the will of the entire community, his writings, according to Dr. Michael A. Meyer, seemed to indicate his willingness to eliminate some of the piyutim, the medieval liturgical poems, to grant permission to kitnias, legumes of certain grains, such as rites on Passover, Pesach, and perhaps eliminate the second day of Yontov outside Eretz Yisrael. I mean, as provided, of course, the community would be willing. He was not opposed to the playing of the organ on Shabbos or Yontov, provided it was played by a non-Jew, and provided that the community did not regard this particular musical instrument as being associated with the church. In the year 1854, after serving as chief rabbi of Saxony for 18 years, Dr. Frankel was appointed to be the head of the newly formed Jewish Theological Seminary in Breslau. Viewed as a person who both combined Talmudic and halachic learning with Wissenschaft des Judentums, expertise in the science of Judaism, Frankel was the logical choice for the position. In addition, he was a person who was on the whole a traditionalist, yet favored moderate reform. It seems that Dr. Abraham Geiger, who was the chief rabbi of Breslau at the time, was very disappointed that he was overlooked for the position, and as a result, when the office of chief rabbi in the city of Frankfurt became open, in the year 1863, he left Breslau and returned to his native Frankfurt to become its chief rabbi. In Breslau, Frankel spread his message of the positive historical development of Judaism and soon hired his professor of history as well as Talmud, Heinrich Gretz, whose History of the Jews was soon to become a classical history text. Gretz, too, supported Frankel's vision of the ongoing development of Judaism. Both Gretz and Frankel's historical writings were subject to sharp analytical criticism by Avraham Shamsher Hirsch in his periodical Yeshurun. That will be discussed in the next lecture. After heading the seminary for some 21 years, Frankel passed away in the year 1875 at the age of 74. In 1879, 4 years after his death, the seminary had instructed some 272 students and had placed 120 teachers, preachers, and rabbis in some of the most important Jewish communities in Europe. It was the policy of the seminary that its graduates received doctorates from recognized universities and would devote themselves to the advancement of Wissenschaft des Judentums, the so-called science of Judaism. This focus was combined with traditional Talmudic and biblical studies. On the whole, though, the graduates of the seminary continued on the path of their mentor, the path of modern reform, and the undermining of the traditional view of the centrality of Torah and Halacha. Rav Israel Hildesheimer, the founder of the Orthodox Rabbinical Seminary in Berlin, commented that there was little difference between, quote, the reformers of the Jewish Theological Seminary who did their work with silk gloves and the reformer Geiger who did his work with a sledgehammer, end quote. Rav Shamsher Fol Hirsch, who felt that Frankel was an apokryphus, someone who denied the Mosaic and divine source of the oral law, Torah Shebaal Peh, justified his public criticism of Frankel in his journal Yeshurun in the following manner, quote, "We want to make certain that if someday a teacher or rabbi who graduated from the seminary is considered for appointment as a teacher or rabbi for his community, even the lowliest beggar in Israel will know the sort of Judaism for which the seminary is training teachers and rabbis. He will then be in a position to decide for himself whether that sort of Judaism is indeed his own Judaism, and can then make his decision and act with open eyes in keeping with a God and his conscience, bid him to do. And if he does not accept that sort of Judaism as his own, and as part of Judaism eternal, he should be in possession of evidence which he can cite on behalf of his stand." That was Rav Shamsher Fol's justification of publicizing his critique of Dr. Frankel. Frankel himself had the outer appearance of a Talmud Chacham, with a beard and payas. In 1861, when Frankel became the object of severe criticism by Rav Shamsher Fol Hirsch, students and colleagues of Frankel came to his defense. One interesting letter that was sent to Rav Hirsch was by a young student of Frankel's, Hermann Cohen, who later left the seminary and went on to become Germany's leading neo-Kantian philosopher. He also became a leading spokesman for the most radical wing of Reform Judaism and, at the end of his life, taught at the Reform Liberal College for Jewish Studies in Berlin. At the time he wrote the letter, however, in 1861, Cohen was still a student of Frankel's. He described his teacher as being an observant Jew who conducted himself in all respects in a strict, traditionally Jewish manner. Quote, "Standing in the synagogue with his tallis, prayer shawl over his head, singing Zmiris on holiday evenings, and also on occasion in his Talmudic lectures, zealously commenting, quote, a God-fearing person must here be stringent, end quote. Rav Hirsch replied in an open letter in Yeshurun that Frankel's level of practice was unimportant unless it was accompanied by proper beliefs. An affirmation of divinity and Mosaic roots of the oral law of the Torah Shebaal Peh was as crucial to authentic Judaism as the belief of the Torah Shebiksav, the written law. Now, this point and the actual belief system of Dr. Frankel is the subject of the next lecture. The conservative movement in America views itself as a continuation of Dr. Frankel's approach to Judaism. Unlike the Jewish Theological Seminary in Breslau, where the Bible was considered sacrosanct, beyond the criticism of Wissenschaft and historical development, the Theological Seminary in America, the flagship institution for the conservative movement, eventually embraced Bible criticism and has abandoned much of the halakhic underpinnings of the original movement. One can only speculate what Dr. Frankel would think today of the movement that he founded. One can say, however, with certainty that the physical and spiritual descendants of Shamsher Fol Hirsch, Frankel's bitter critic, are alive and well, spreading Torah in its unadulterated form, immersed in its study and continuing his vision. That speaks for itself. In conclusion, I would like to quote a letter from Rabbi Israel Hildesheimer concerning the Jewish Theological Seminary in Breslau, which is this is printed here on pages 256 and 257 in the well-researched biography of Rav Shamsher Fol Hirsch by Rav Eliyahu Meir Klugman. I quote, "I know for a fact," Hildesheimer wrote of Frankel, "that he is entirely unconcerned with the religious beliefs of the students of the seminary. This interests him not at all. For some time now, I consider it to my credit that I restrain young men from going to study in Breslau. There they only become hypocrites and worse. And it continues on Gretz. Yes, Gretz. Teaches there a class in Gomorrah. What a mockery under the guise of Judaism. It is an unprecedented disgrace, and whoever sees this must suppress his inner anguish. I see with my own eyes how youth are led there to the slaughter, one after another, and reduced to a level lower than the wicked ones of Israel. They are made into hypocrites, Jesuits, and heretics just like Gretz, who, as I know from a reliable source, sways with his four species on Sukkah, Sarva Minim, like some Hasidic Rebbe. End quote. In the next lecture, we will probe further the theoretical underpinning of Frankl's and Gretz's approach to Judaism and the bitter criticism of their opponents, such as Rav Shamshon Fol Hirsch and other Talmidei Chachamim and Talmudic scholars. Now, are there any questions? Yeah, so you're asking that basically if the sentiment would be such that they would acquiesce to the, as a whole, the Jewish people as a whole, then he would accept that. Mm-hmm. Well, that is the state of the conservative movement as it stands today. Well,
Reform Judaism and conservative Judaism were responding to their time. 7 8 Jews were uninterested. Did the Orthodox community reach out to these people? Was there a care movement?
Yeah, so you're asking, what about, there was a problem here that those of the assembly came to address. What was the thing of the Orthodox? Actually, there were two approaches. One, which was not really in Germany, but which is in Hungary, was that of the followers of the Chasam Sofer, which they basically isolated themselves from the Reform, put tremendous effort in the encouragement of the study of Torah and the heightening of religious sensitivities, and created a very large religious community that adhered very strictly to Judaism in its letter and in its spirit. The other movement really came with it from Germany. It came from Sham Shon Fol Hirsch and those of his school. And they were not reformers in the sense that we're reading today, but had their finger on the pulse of Jewry and presented, packaged Judaism in a way that was attractive and fit into the world view of those of Jewry himself. And to the extent that he was probably the most successful in those who followed in his footsteps. Those who remained frum in Germany and were not swept over were as a result of the efforts of the Sham Shon Fol Hirsch. And what he did was that it basically slowed the process of, it offered an alternative. In other words, as we're going to say in another lecture, one of the leaders in Frankfurt, who eventually became part of the leader of the congregation of Sham Shon Fol Hirsch, describes his growing up in Frankfurt that he was the only one who put on tefillin, and he was mocked for it. In other words, religiosity was associated with the older generation who was dying out. Rav Sham Shon Fol Hirsch reversed that tendency and created schools that combined both a schooling that would prepare them to be integrated in society and yet full of the spirit of Torah. So really that was the response. But that will be the subject of future lectures. Yeah.
In 1840, there was a discourse, apparently intelligent letters by well-educated people who had different ideas, of course, but were communicating with words and letters and perhaps politeness, even though it was What exists today in the realm of Reform, conservatism, and Orthodoxy in exchange of ideas, and or does nothing exist today? I mean, is there an exchange of letters still on theological issues, or is that sort of a past?
Yeah, you're saying about the exchange of letters. The exchange of letters here were people who were interested in Reform. And they were trying to influence the people at large. The people who were very deeply Orthodox did not address them directly, but they addressed their congregants, or those who were to strengthen them. But they did not direct those of Reform. Yeah.
You spoke about confirmation. What happened to Bar and Bas Mitzvah? Did they do that, or this was this replaced by?
Yeah, so you're asking with Bar and Bas Mitzvah. Basically, what the confirmation did is really replace the Bar Mitzvah. Yeah. And this we discussed it in the lectures of last year, and how it came about, this confirmation ceremony. But basically, is that the Bar Mitzvah, generally as it is today in very committed circles, that the Bachar Bar Mitzvah lanes, you know, he says a pilpul, he says a drasha, it's indicative of his background. Those of the Reform movement, really, their kids weren't prepared for that. We view when we tend to say the Reform is the villain that destroyed everything. They were a contributing factor of something that was in the process of being destroyed. Had all of these Reform rabbis taken the view of Sham Shaphol Hirsch, it would have helped. But I don't believe that it would have stopped the process of acculturation. There were people just not religious people, and that was not the mood of
the yeshivas.
Now you're asking about the yeshivas. The yeshivas, because of what was happening in the mood and the Reform, and when Reform, those leaders of Reform, even the laity, became in power, basically the yeshivas were closed down. I mean, there were places that had yeshivas. That's where Reform was not dominant. You had in Altona, where Yaakov Ettlinger, who was a Rebbe of Rosham Shaphol Hirsch, Altona is a suburb of Hamburg, that for a long period had a yeshiva. But eventually that closed, probably because of lack of interest. You had in southern Germany, which was much more traditional, you had some yeshivas. But eventually the yeshivas petered out. You know, as a yeshiva. Like with Sham Shaphol Hirsch and Frankfurt was not able to make a yeshiva. The people really did not want it. It was a whole different mindset. When Sham Shaphol Hirsch's son-in-law, this became his successor, the Shlomo Breuer, he made it a condition that he would only accept it, the position, if they would provide him with a yeshiva. This is on a higher level. He had tremendous resistance. They didn't want it. Like, it was just, the view of the integrated German, you know, who was a religious person, who followed the mitzvahs, was sufficient for them. They viewed yeshiva as being Eastern European, something that they didn't want. So, it was an uphill battle having yeshivas in Germany. And in fact, it was only in the period, late 20s and 30s, that there was a movement amongst some German Bochum to go to Eastern Europe and to be part of the yeshivas, because they didn't have something which was sufficient for their needs within Germany.
How far did this radiate out? Was it strictly Germany, all that's going on? Like you said, for instance, Hungary had a bit and they fought against it, but did it affect any other areas as well?
No, basically is the area of interest is Germany. France already had become assimilated. Here there was still a struggle. In Hungary, Reform was in infancy. But there was still a great number, we don't call them Reform, of people who really were not religious people. You know, so there was a struggle. I mean, this is really dealing how to deal. Every generation has its challenges. We had the challenge of Schmad, of a forced forced conversion. We had all different. So this was one of the challenges, and it was, and the response was varied. One of the major problems is, historically, is when you have a challenge, and you notice is that the old system is really not working adequately. But what steps do you take? Because the fear of any changes I make may destroy what I have already. So that's. This is something we'll discuss in future lectures. A good
they did not understand because there was no chinuch that they used, that we got to the stage where people were 7 hours of age, they're not shown many because there was no.
Right, because the major problem was also was a contributing factor that the education was so poor.
Yeah.